Our next case is 13-109, State of Ohio versus Thomas Kane White. For the appellant, Ms. Jarrett.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'm Evie Jarrett, appearing on behalf of the Lucas County Prosecutor's Office and the State of Ohio. This case involves a number of issues arising out of an on-duty shooting of a motorcyclist during a traffic stop. I'm going to turn first to the questions related to the jury instructions that were provided in this case. To put those in context, I think it's helpful to review exactly how these jury instructions arrived at the point they were given. Both parties, the state and the defendant, requested jury instructions to the trial court. The defendant's request had four relevant portions, and they're divided a little bit differently in the actual instructions if you pull those. Both sets of instructions are made part of the record in this case. They are available for this court's review. White requested an instruction that the jury should determine whether his use of force was objectively reasonable under the circumstances. That was a jury instruction that was based on a case, Skinner v. Brooks, as well as other Ohio case law. He also requested an instruction that whether White had a reasonable, honest belief he or his fellow officer was about to be killed or receive great bodily injury, that the jury should make that determination. That instruction was based on a standard OJI self-defense instruction. He asked that the jury be instructed that they should judge the reasonableness of his conduct in light of the circumstances confronting him, Officer White, in the moments leading up to that shooting, without the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, and that instruction was drawn from a U.S. Supreme Court case, Graham v. Connor. And finally, White asked that the jury be instructed that what seems reasonable is different when the officer faces an assailant, as opposed to when the jury is reviewing this at its leisure, and that allowances have to be made for split-second decisions and circumstances that are tense and rapidly evolving. The trial court gave those instructions. And I think it's key to review exactly what the state had tendered as well in this case. The state had tendered essentially several self-defense instructions.
Counsel, if I may, I understand what you're saying, what was requested and what was given. Is that an incorrect statement of the law?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. All of these issues, all of these instructions, return the jury's attention to what is objectively reasonable under the circumstances. It all brings us back to, as the U.S. Supreme Court phrases it, that fact-bound morass of what's reasonable under the circumstances. Every single one of those instructions returned the jury's attention to that.
Well, then I'm a little confused by your argument here. You're the appellant this morning, correct?
That's correct.
And you're telling me that everything the trial court did was fine?
That is correct. What happened was when the Sixth District reviewed this case, the Sixth District worked very hard to find flaws in these instructions that were given. The Sixth District identified to me two primary issues with these jury instructions. First, the Sixth District said, well, these instructions really are modeled on the Graham v. Connor excessive force standard, as opposed to the deadly force standard that the Supreme Court articulated in Tennessee v. Garner. And we have too much respect for human life to allow this lesser excessive force standard to be given when deadly force was obviously used. That was one problematic area that the Court of Appeals identified. The second problematic area that the court identified was the absence of a mistake instruction. I had a little trouble in terms of analyzing the mistake instruction. It was unclear to me exactly what the court was looking for. There was a reference to the Saussure case, which would suggest that the Sixth District wanted something that suggested reasonable beliefs could still be mistaken.
Counsel, you went through four specific instructions that the defendant requested. Did the prosecution object to those, or were they?
The prosecution asked the trial court to put these instructions in the context of the case law that they were drawn from. There were two requests that we made. We abandoned those self-defense instructions that we had originally tendered, and we said, all right, if you're going to give the Skinner v. Brooks case, that first instruction, put it in the context of the actual Skinner v. Brooks case, where it said that if the defendant uses more force than reasonably, again, we're getting back to that reasonable standard, reasonably necessary in pursuing his official duties, the defense is not available. By the same token, we ask that the trial court instruct the jury as to the permissible factors under Graham v. Connor, the kinds of things it could consider. It wasn't an exclusive list. They said you can consider such factors as whether he's evading arrest, whether there's an immediate threat, whether he's committed a felony, the severity of the offense he's suspected to have committed. So those were the two alterations that we requested. We did not object to.
And the fourth one, would you go through that again? The fourth one that you identified.
The request that we made those factors?
No, that the defense requested and obtained.
What the defense requested with respect to Graham v. Connor and related federal case law was what constitutes reasonable action may seem quite different to someone facing a possible assailant rather than to someone who's analyzing the question at leisure, and that allowance has to be made for the fact that officers are forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving.
And that comes from a federal case?
Yes, Your Honor. It comes from Graham v. Connor, okay. A U.S. Supreme Court case. But Graham v. Connor went on to say you can consider such factors as the severity of the crime believed to be committed, whether I'll just call him the victim, Mr. McCluskey, the motorcyclist, was posing an immediate threat to the safety of the defendant or another person, whether he was actively attempting to evade arrest.
Yeah, and your point is that those collectively were a correct statement of the law, but pretty generous as well, aren't they?
Your Honor, I do believe that that is correct. And to the extent there is this sharp division between deadly force and excessive force, if that still remains, and that's up for some debate, but to the extent that that sharp division that the Sixth District recognized still exists, the lower standard of excessive force is going to favor the defendant, and that's what he got here. The other issue was the question of the mistake instruction. And the Sixth District said, we recognize that there's some case law saying that when you've got a knowingly definition given, that a mistake instruction may not be plain. The absence of a mistake instruction may not be plain error. We're unwilling to do that here. I think there are a couple problems with that. First of all, to put it in the context once more, these are the instructions that the defense counsel requested. And to further put it in context, if you pull the instructions that the state actually tendered, it included a standard self-defense instruction that said a belief can be reasonable but mistaken. And it's not referred to as such in the transcript. They referred to those instructions by number. But defense counsel said, we have agreed, we, the state and defendant, have agreed that we will give my OJI instructions and the state will withdraw that request.
Ms. Jarrett, could you go to the first proposition? Because that's the one relating to the constitutionality of the firearm specification as applied to a police officer.
Yes, Your Honor. The Sixth District held that the firearm specification, and this is the 3-year specification for use or brandishment of a firearm, they held that this is unconstitutional, that it violates due process when it's applied to a peace officer who is convicted of an act committed in the scope of his employment. I have two problems with that analysis. First of all, a peace officer, a police officer, is expected to enforce the laws of the state. One of the reasons that these cases are so seldom prosecuted is because they enjoy a lot of trust, of respect. They have a lot of credibility with jurors. We expect them to safeguard our communities. We don't expect them to be committing a crime. Once that finding of a criminal act is made, it's the state's position that he's outside the scope of what he's employed to do.
Counsel, philosophically, why should this not have been a 1983 action only, a civil matter, instead of a criminal case?
Justice Lanziger, I think it's telling, and it's part of the record, the remark that Officer White made immediately after the shooting. He didn't say, "I hope the village of Ottawa Hills doesn't have to pay money," or more appropriately, that its insurer doesn't have to pay money. He said, "I hope I don't wind up going to jail." I mean, it's quite simple that this is an additional layer of deterrence to bad conduct. I also think that it's important that we prosecute.
What do you think would be foremost in the mind of an officer when they discharge their weapon? Civil liability or their personal freedom? Why is that statement so out of the ordinary and telling?
Well, one reason is because the practicality of the matter is that very seldom is there personal liability for this.
And I'm talking about, well, I understand that, but, you know, I just don't see that statement as being as telling as you are trying to make it out, that, you know, rather than being concerned about the civil liability here and the fact the insurance company or the village would have to compensate for him to be first and foremost worried about his personal freedom.
Chief Justice, I think this goes to what individuals in law enforcement regard as quite an important thing, and that's compliance with law, the criminal act itself.
So do you think are you characterizing that as an admission on behalf of Officer White that I just broke the law, I sure hope I don't go to jail?
No, Your Honor, for purposes of these arguments, I wouldn't make that argument. I think that kind of argument may have occurred in the trial court. I don't recall specifically. But no, for purposes of these arguments.
If we can go back to the statute for a second, Justice Lanziger has raised the question, are you defending the constitutionality of the firearm spec versus a police officer who's doing his job? Because the Sixth District seems to me to have said, as applied in this case, that's an unconstitutional statute. Can you tell me why a police officer carrying a gun, which he's required to do, ends up with an enhanced penalty? I don't understand that.
Justice O'Neill, he certainly is required to carry the gun, and he's authorized to use it. He's not required to use it, and he's certainly not required to use it in a means that later is a criminal act, is found to be a criminal act. Once he crosses that line into committing a felonious assault, the firearm specification can appropriately be applied.
But aren't these split-second decisions that officers are called to make when apprehending individuals in motor vehicles or motorcycles? I mean,
certainly.
But for 2 seconds or three,
and
we may have a different case tried here with other people sitting at the defendant's table.
And
how can you be so callous about that?
Your Honor, it is not the state's intent to be callous about this, and we approach these cases with a great deal of deliberation and consideration for the evidence. As I said, police officers do enjoy a great deal of trust, and as a result, I think, and we prosecutors depend on that. We know that when we put a case on, we're, I don't know that I've ever seen a case that didn't involve a law enforcement individual testifying. We know that. We don't like any more than anyone else to be in a position of...
But in response to the chief's question, I mean, I hope I don't end up going to jail. How would you extrapolate that into some form of admission? I mean, isn't that highly judgmental on your part?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it gives a clear... What is of concern at that point in time is more the criminal liability. I believe this discussion started originally, why isn't this just a 1983 case and leave it at that? And my response to that is it crossed the line into criminal conduct.
And counsel, the how much immunity is to be given to an officer, is that part of the equation here? I mean, I know that they're in the briefs, the argument is that officers are not immune from prosecution for criminal acts, just as the general public would not be immune. Does the mens rea in this particular case, the fact that we're talking about knowingly as opposed to purposely, make a difference? I mean, if it were any other individual doing what this officer did, there'd be no reason, for example, to have a gun and to shoot someone in the back. They're just...
I believe that that's certainly what the jury is confronted with. When they watch the videotape, they hear the officer testify. They're looking at any potential threat. They assess the situation, and there's simply no meaningful way. White approached this motorcycle from the left, from the rear left, so that, and the motorcyclist was positioned with his left hand on the handlebars. It's a 750-pound motorcycle. The right hand was what he initially raised to his head, let it drop to his thigh, turned to see what was going on, made a second movement when White yelled something. And at that point, the shooting occurred.
At no time did he show his hands like he was instructed to do.
Your Honor, I cannot imagine that he could possibly have heard that command over the sirens that were going around him.
Is that what he testified to?
Yes.
Counsel, the gun spec, that's mandatory or discretionary?
Once it's found by the jury.
No, I'm talking about prosecutor discretion now.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that that is a point where the prosecutor could exercise discretion in terms of whether to attach it.
I mean, it's there to be used.
Correct.
But it's also taking police officers out of this in cases against criminals who hold up the drugstore or whatever. Prosecutors in plea bargaining sometimes take that off the table, right? Can.
They could, yes. I believe that
the statute is not...
It's not automatic.
Such that once you have an indictment, you can't take it away. Right. You can go forward on the underlying charge, even though a gun, in fact, was present, was wielded. All the elements of the gun spec are present. The prosecutor does have the discretion to take that off the table and just go forward with the underlying charge.
I believe that's correct, that you could amend the indictment by interlineation and omit that. I've never looked specifically at it, but I would think that once, prior to the jury making its determination, I would think that the prosecutor would have the option to do that.
So I guess what I'm wondering, my question is different than Justice Lansinger's. Why put this court
in the position of having to make a call on constitutionality of it as applied.
Well, quite simply.
Why didn't you just take that off the table? I mean, I know something about the original reasons for the gun spec, and this surely doesn't fit.
The constitutional issue wasn't raised in the trial court. We had no idea that this would develop into an issue. Once it did.
Well, what was the wisdom? What was the thinking of putting the gun spec in the case?
The indictments that I've seen.
I mean, you surely know common sense tells you the legislature didn't intend this to be applied to this kind of a situation.
I believe that the gun spec was created to deter violent crime involving a firearm.
Right.
When we have a violent crime that involves a firearm, it's not unusual. I can't say that Lucas County invariably does it, but it is
certainly
common.
But the gun spec's there to keep criminals from bringing guns along when they go in and...
I balk at that kind of analysis because it draws this distinction between someone who has a criminal history, you know, who's a habitual criminal,
or is about to have a criminal history.
I'm sorry.
Or is about to have a criminal history.
But
isn't the idea that the law is to apply equally without respect to persons, and in this situation, the state looked at the individual without regard to status? Is that how this happened?
I believe that this was attached as we would attach a firearm specification to any felonious assault charge that involves the use of a firearm.
That's the question we have to deal with, whether there should be an exception because of the nature of the individual.
That's correct. The 6th District draws that sharp line between police officers on the one hand and everybody else who's got, you know, either the habitual criminal past or would be about to commit a crime. But they make that distinction. I don't see that on the surface of the statute. It doesn't align analytically with what I perceive to be the due process test. You know, we reserve finding a violation of due process for the most egregious applications of authority, and to suggest that when we do apply...
Well, legislators can't anticipate every possible application of a statute that some prosecutor might decide to come up with.
But
legislators do assume some reasonable level of judgment and discretion by prosecutors.
That's correct, but I think that when we...
So was it here as an effort to get a plea bargain?
I have to confess a little ignorance as to the plea bargaining process in this matter. I was involved in the trial court proceedings. I'm unaware that there were any discussions whatsoever.
Okay.
I apologize for not being able to answer that.
Thank you. Counsel? Mr. Galliard?
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Peter Galliard for Officer White. I'm sharing time with Christina Coral with the National and Ohio Fraternal Orders of Police. I'd like to save her as close to 5 minutes as possible. Here, the linchpin of liability is reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. That principle impacts all the issues in this case. In short, the jury did not get the constitutionally mandated tools that it needed to make a proper constitutional reasonableness determination under the Fourth Amendment. Counsel's characterization that the instruction given is an accurate statement of the law is incorrect in one way and correct in the others to the extent that it's partially an accurate statement of the law. There were two errors here which independently warrant reversal, and that's what the Sixth District Court of Appeals did. The first is an error of exclusion, and that is that the mistaken belief can also be an objectively reasonable belief. The jury here thought that Officer White had to be right to be reasonable.
You're saying that there was not an instruction given on the fact that a mistaken belief can be reasonable?
Correct.
And you asked for that?
In substance, it was asked for. The Court of Appeals acknowledges this in paragraph 112, 117, and 123 of its opinion. It goes on to apply a plain error standard on this mistaken belief issue, but it uses the words, aside from plain error, counsel's discussion leading up to the instruction was sufficient to preserve this issue. Ultimately, that's inconsequential because this rises to the level of plain error. It is a constitutionally mandated requirement.
You gave us a lot of words in response to the chief's question. Was the proper instruction, what you believe to be the proper instruction, actually asked for by defense counsel?
Not in whole.
Isn't that a problem?
No. As the Court of Appeals held, it rises to the level of plain error.
But counsel, isn't what you're talking about a distinction between subjective, what's subjectively reasonable, and what is objectively reasonable? And as the Court of Appeals did point out several times, the jury had the actual footage of the video. They had the video to see several times. They could determine from the video what objectively was reasonable, could they not?
They could not, because the Constitution requires that the jury has to know that Officer White could be both wrong and reasonable. And this is the crux. It comes into play and is of the utmost importance with the video.
Why doesn't the 2020 instruction talk about that? The instructions that were given regarding you can't use hindsight to determine what was reasonable at the time. It has to be what the person is observing at the time.
Correct. But that doesn't bring into play whether you could be mistaken on what is the rationale for you to make an ultimate decision. To a layperson, to the jury, reasonable is the equivalent of logical, sensible, fair, just. If I make a decision.
But you requested an instruction on reasonableness, did you not?
There was a reasonableness instruction crafted by defense and the state, and the court used segments of each as part of the instruction that it gave.
Well, I believe Ms. Jarrett read it to us, and it was proposed instruction 3, what constitutes reasonable action may seem different to someone facing an assailant than to someone analyzing a question at leisure. That's what you're arguing to us.
And that's not the—
Allowance must be made for the fact that officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and evolving. That was your instruction, if I understand it right.
That was correct? Trial counsel's requested instruction.
And was that given?
That was, but that's only part of the instruction that the Constitution requires to be given.
But you're saying you didn't offer anything. You're arguing now about an instruction that wasn't proffered to the court.
The Court of Appeals found that in substance it was proffered to the court. When they discussed negligent assault, this mistake of fact component was discussed thoroughly. And it was also brought up by the judge that I don't think this is a negligent assault. I think the mistake has more to do with the self-defense. And then ultimately they decide not to offer the self-defense instruction. And the mistake of fact piece either falls through the cracks or it's never explicitly discussed again. But again, the Court of Appeals held that in substance, aside from plain error, this instruction was preserved on the record. Nonetheless, it is plain error because the Constitution absolutely requires it.
I think that's about the fourth time I've heard you say that. Can you direct me to where the Constitution requires that?
It's from the U.S. Supreme Court precedent interpreting the Fourth Amendment.
In Graham? Are you talking about Graham?
I'm talking, it's more so in Saucier.
I guess what I'm having trouble with is when you're telling us the Constitution requires something. I guess it goes to my original question with your learned opposing counsel. They believe that the instructions given adequately address the law of Ohio, including the 2020 and the moments leading up to this jury was told he can have a reasonable, honest belief, correct? That instruction was given.
That he could have a reasonable, honest, I don't know that those words were used.
You understand, in the Graham case, they're talking about reasonable, honest belief that he was about to be fired upon.
I don't recall those specific words. It is a totality of the circumstances, and is the act reasonable under those?
And I guess what I'm following Justice O'Donnell's questioning. Are you saying the totality of the circumstances of the instructions somehow left the officer short of his constitutional rights?
Yes, in two ways. The mistaken piece that we've been discussing, and there was the second error was one of inclusion, and what the instruction included, and this came purely from the state and was clearly objected to by defense counsel, is there was more force than necessary language that was included. That's not a proper determination under the Fourth Amendment. It's only proper in an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment case. It actually constitutes the conclusion that the jury had to reach. It's not a component of the standard.
I'm trying to follow you. You're saying an instruction that whether or not the officer used more force than was reasonably necessary is an improper instruction on a police shooting case?
Correct. That language appears nowhere in Garner, Graham, or Scott v. Harris, which are the three cases from the U.S. Supreme Court. Also, it puts into the jury's mind, could the officer have done something less? And that's clearly not an appropriate consideration under the Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard as detailed by the United States Supreme Court. And when I say that these are constitutionally required, I mean that the United States Supreme Court has interpreted the Fourth Amendment in this context, in this way, to require them. Clearly, there's no language in the Constitution that says these things. It's from the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court has held that there are constitutionally defined parameters for certain reasonableness considerations. This is not the only area where reasonableness is specifically defined by the Constitution as interpreted
by the U.S. You're taking Fourth Amendment reasonableness and you're applying it to a situation involving force. So in a sense, we have a disconnect to begin with, don't we? I mean, you're talking about Fourth Amendment constitutional descriptions of what is reasonable.
Right.
And we're talking about turning it to a totally different scenario involving whether an officer's activity itself was reasonable with respect to force that was used.
No, Your Honor. Graham says that the Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard applies to all claims of force, which is this exact context.
This criminal case. Was Graham a criminal case?
No, it was a 1983
right.
case.
Right, so we have that problem in terms of talking about 1983 actions and importing some of that into a criminal case.
We have to import it because there's no guideposts elsewhere, and it is explicit statements from the U.S. Supreme Court that all claims are determined under that standard.
And that gets to the whole point of your discussion that this is a unique situation. You've got a unique defendant who should be treated differently than any other person who was charged.
He's a state actor. It's fundamentally different. The Fourth Amendment governs state actors' actions.
And the reasonableness standard applies to the action or the activity, whether it's a 1983 or, as we have in this situation, it's the same conduct that gives rise, and whether it's pursued as a 1983 or as in a criminal action, it still is judged by a reasonableness standard.
That's exactly correct. Liability, the linchpin of liability, is reasonableness in these.
And it's whether the
context.
Sanction is criminal or civil.
That is correct.
And it's the same level of review then for reasonable under both types of cases? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's an objective standard that the U.S. Supreme Court has laid out in its case law.
Is one of the problems here for your client the fact that there was a video and the fact that the jurors viewed that video, which only gives a limited import of knowledge to them and disregards, I think, in many instances, you can never duplicate the officer's state of mind, perceptions, that sort of thing here. So in ways, I'm just thinking that this reliance on the jurors had the video to look at and then made this conclusion doesn't tell the whole story.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The video needs to be viewed in its proper context. And in its proper context, the jury had to know that Officer White could be wrong whether Mr. McCloskey had a gun and could be wrong whether he's reaching for his hip. The camera's view is not Officer White's view. Officer White could only see Mr. McCloskey's back. He could not see his hand. He saw his right elbow bent and engaged. And when Mr. McCloskey turned, that bent, engaged elbow closed the distance to his hip. At that time, Officer White was absolutely certain he was pulling a gun, and he shot.
But he also has to base all of that on what led up to the stop. Isn't that part of this? And
thank you.
The jury didn't see that, correct?
The jury did see that.
They did?
Yes, and there's pressure building. However, once you see the end of the video, this visceral human situation where a person is shot, it's easy to forget just how much pressure was building in Officer White's mind as this pursuit occurred. But most importantly, the jury had to know that Officer White could be wrong that he had a gun and wrong whether he's reaching a gun.
Well, counsel, is it common to a traffic stop for speeding or fleeing for the officers to pull out their weapon?
It was imperative in this case because the other officer acted the same way. Now, that officer
what do you mean the other officer acted in the same way?
Well, in this pursuit, there's two motorcycles riding down the road, and then they split. One goes over the embankment or the
So curve, they both the draw island. Their guns on they, these cyclists.
They both draw their guns. And
And because the other officer did it, that makes it reasonable.
Yes, the pressure that built throughout this, ultimately that's for the jury to decide, but the pressure that built throughout this pursuit indicated that they needed to pull their weapons.
How fast were they going?
There was no radar,
but how fast? On
the last one, it was suspected that it was about 40 miles per hour in a 25.
There was a period of time where everybody's on the speed limit, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'd like to reserve the remainder of the time for Ms. Coral.
Good morning. Christina Coral, I, along with my partner Larry James, represent the National and State of Ohio Fraternal Order of Police. And if I may be so bold, after hearing the arguments and the questions from the court, I'd like to take the amicus 30,000-foot view of this case. And that is this. For purposes of both the jury instructions analysis and the constitutionality analysis, you have to understand that a police officer acting and discharging his service weapon in the line of duty is just fundamentally different from an armed robber holding up a gas station.
I think we understand that.
So, and let me...
Can't understand why the prosecutor put it in the case, but
right. We
understand the difference.
So from a jury instruction perspective, I also want to back up just a little bit and look at the fact that really what happened here, from what I can glean from the record, was that both parties agreed that this Fourth Amendment analysis really should play a part in instructing the jury. And I think we can understand why that would happen, because if this police officer had been civilly prosecuted under 1983, those are the exact jury instructions to which he would be entitled in that civil case. So why then would he be entitled to anything less in this criminal case that deals with taking away his personal freedom?
Counsel, are you suggesting that an officer should never be criminally prosecuted for actions in the line of duty?
No, absolutely not. I am only suggesting that if an officer is criminally prosecuted for actions in the line of duty, that he be entitled to the same types of protections and jury instructions to which he would be entitled if he was civilly prosecuted for that same.
But the defense counsel didn't ask for them.
Well, now, that may be applicable to one issue. On the issue of the excessive use of force, there clearly was an objection from defense counsel as to inserting that excessive use of force analysis in the jury instructions.
Well, isn't that proper when a police officer has shot someone for a jury to be asked, was that excessive force?
The only thing that's relevant in that case is if the force is reasonable. And this is why that distinction is important. Instead of having the jury simply looking at the perspective of the police officer and saying, a police officer, a trained professional in that position, was it reasonable for him to discharge his weapon? That's reasonable, okay? What the court injected was instead this analysis, which is, the jury needed to think about, did he really need to go that far? Did he do more than was necessary? Could he have tased him? Could he have done a whole list of other things? Those analyses are totally different under the Constitution. Quite frankly, the law is, from what we can glean, is that the excessive force instruction really has no place in the Fourth Amendment analysis.
Well, here you could look at it and wonder whether there was any force necessary.
Well, that goes right back to the reasonableness analysis, and that is the crux of the case. Did the action that the officer took, was it reasonable? As opposed to substituting the jury's own judgment about, well, could he have done this, could he have done that? Now, I am not saying that juries might not do that. Juries might very well do that in an analysis.
It was just a traffic stop, was it not?
Yes, it was just a traffic stop. But if you look at the statistics about the number of police officers that are killed in the course of routine traffic stops.
They don't draw their weapons generally in a routine traffic stop, do they?
Well, hopefully not. The problem is when police officers encounter situations where they fear that they have to draw their weapons, then we have to take a step back and make sure that if they are criminally tried on cases like this, they get the proper jury instruction. That proper instruction from our position is that they should be entitled to the same instruction they would get if they were being civilly prosecuted.
Counsel, can you move on to the constitutional question for just a moment? I see your red light is on, so I'll ask my question quickly. If we were to agree with the reasoning that supports your argument that it would be unconstitutional as applied on the weapon spec, wouldn't that same reasoning lead to the conclusion that the deadly weapon form of felonious assault itself is also unconstitutional? What's the limit of your reasoning? Wouldn't it also mean that you could never charge a police officer with a deadly weapon felonious assault if they're within the line of duty? Do you see what I'm concerned about the limit of your argument.
I see exactly what you're saying. Yes, I do see what you're saying. So the limit of the argument is that, yes, we obviously know that police officers can be prosecuted for felonious assault in the course of duty, and it goes back to the reasonableness analysis. And I do understand the exact question you're asking. The answer is to then provide an enhancement, because police officers can be prosecuted for the commission of a crime on duty, felonious assault, whatever it is. But then to ignore that officer's status, and remember, this is just about the gun. This is just about having a gun in the commission of a crime. To ignore the police officer's status as someone that's sworn to uphold the law, is required to carry a gun, and quite frankly is expected to use it, and then take the sentence enhancement, a purpose for which the statute was never intended, And to apply that to the police officer in this context is what we believe leads to the unconstitutionality of the application.
Was it the having of the gun, though, that was argued to the jury? Wasn't it the discharge?
Yes.
I mean, it was the use, because everyone knows officers carry guns. We're not talking about criminalizing that. It's the use.
Absolutely, it was the use. And so to split hairs and say it's okay if an officer... Let me strike that. You can't have an officer that's required to carry a gun and expected to use it, then be criminally prosecuted for actually using it in a case such as this, where it really turns out to be a horrible mistake and a horrible misjudgment.
So you were going to, let me just stop you right there. If there was no question that a crime was committed by the officer and he utilized the gun to commit that crime, you're arguing that no crime was committed by this officer, that he was reasonable in discharging his weapon, given the totality of the circumstances, the heat of the moment, et cetera, based on experience, et cetera. But say you didn't have that kind of a defense here, and it was a blatant misuse of his firearm, no matter what the motivation, no matter what the circumstances, it was a blatant misuse. Just say a police officer sitting in his car, he sees someone walking down the street, and he pulls out his weapon and shoots them. No reason. Are you saying the gun spec is not appropriate under those circumstances?
No, and this is why. Because we view this case from the fundamental starting point that we are talking about police officers that are acting in the line of duty and utilizing their service weapons in the course of their job duties. Sitting in your car and watching someone walk by and pulling out a gun and shooting them is not the job of police officers. So no, that's not our...
So the first analysis, did they commit a crime? And if they did not commit a crime, and that's what the Court of Appeals said, then, you know, the... And I think maybe that might be a little bit missing from the Court of Appeals analysis. There's no way you can get to the three-year gun spec without first finding the crime.
We understand that. We understand that at the end of the day, someone holding up a liquor store and a police officer acting in the line of duty who's convicted of a crime are going to have the same piece of paper of conviction. The problem is that ignores how they got there, and it ignores the legislative intent of the gun spec. So we would ask once again that the Court of Appeals opinion be upheld, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Jarrett, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
I'd like to respond to the issue of putting this video into the proper context. There was ample testimony in this trial that put this video in its proper context. Officer White was permitted to testify exactly to each one of the perceived infractions that he saw as he followed these motorcycles through Ottawa Hills. He was also permitted to testify that Ottawa Hills is a quiet community, that his partner that night was out investigating a noise complaint. There was nothing in the record to suggest that this was an environment that was plagued with the criminal conduct.
Let's get to the crux of the mistaken but reasonable belief, or mistaken belief, but that mistake was reasonable given the circumstances, et cetera. Do you believe that that instruction was given?
I believe that the instructions given, requested by defense counsel, adequately addressed.
That instruction was given, that the officer could be reasonable to have a mistaken belief, and that mistaken belief was reasonable and therefore precludes a conviction here.
Those words were not used, but the instructions did tell the jury that they were to determine whether he had a reasonable, honest belief that he or his partner were facing a threat.
Even if that was a mistaken belief.
The word mistake did not appear, as I said.
Okay.
We tendered the only instruction that used that mistake, and defense counsel requested that his instruction be used. Suddenly we would be looking at more an ineffective assistance of counsel kind of situation, but I don't believe that this was ineffective. I think it was a very well-decided, it was a good position that he took.
So we understand it. So the state's requested instruction would have had the words they're now saying are missing.
That's correct. It was the fourth instruction in the written instructions that we tendered. It was, as I said, I don't second guess this defense counsel at all because it was a self-defense instruction. I believe that he probably reviewed this, said this is way too complicated. There are parts that don't apply in these circumstances. I don't want this. I want the one that I crafted, the one that seems to be easier for the jury to understand, and I respect that decision.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?